Yes. Today is January 12th, Thursday morning at the JCC. We're studying Providence and Theodicy in Chazal. And last time, we just about finished the main body of sources on the subject of Providence and Theodicy in Chazal. And we said that today, we're going to do two things. One is to finish up one source we didn't see last week from the main unit, and then spend most of the time on a additional topic, which is Providence and Theodicy in Chazal in passages that deal with astrology. What I decided to do is not begin the first 10 minutes with the source that we didn't get to last week. We'll leave that to the end, and if we don't get to it, we don't get to it, because I want to begin with astrology, because there's a good chance of finishing this in one day. And again, if we do finish, if we have time at the end, we'll go back to that one source we didn't see last week. So, does everyone have the sources that I gave out today?
Yeah.
It says Providence and Theodicy in Chazal, sources concerning Mazal, Gesher at JCC, January 12, 2012. Good morning. So since I titled this Sources Concerning Mazal, let's talk a minute about that word Mazal. Many people think that Mazal means luck. We say Mazal Tov, good luck, when we want to wish someone well, or when someone has had a important joyous occasion, Mazal Tov, and it means like congratulations. But the truth is that the word Mazal means constellations. That's what it means, constellations. And we specifically talk about Mazal in the sense of constellations and stars ruling or controlling what happens on Earth. That's what Mazal really means. Mazal Tov means may you have a good constellation, and therefore things should be well with you.
Well, we say thank your lucky stars.
Thank your lucky stars.
most people say Mazal.
It's the same thing. That's just Ashkenazi accent. And I'm using the Sephardi accent. But it's the same word. Mem, Zayin, yeah. Lamed. Mazal. Mazal. All of the three sources I have in the sheet for today talk about Mazal. Mazal. Let's read one of the sources. The first one, the short one. And then I'll go back and give a certain introduction to the whole subject of astrology. A short introduction. So this source is from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Moed Katan, page 28a. Rava said, length of life, children and sustenance depend not on schut, not on merit, but on mazal. For take Rabba and Rav Chista, who were two luminaries in the generation before Rava. He's looking back at his teachers, Rabba and Rav Chista. Both were saintly rabbis. One master prayed for rain and it came. The other master prayed for rain and it came. Rav Chista lived to the age of 92. Rabba only lived to the age of 40. In Rav Chista's house, there were held 60 marriage feasts, and at Rabba's house, there were 60 bereavements. At Rav Chista's house, there were the purest wheaten bread for the dogs, and it even went to waste. They didn't need it even for the dogs. At Rabba's house, there was only barley bread for human beings, and that even was often not to be had. If you just see the correspondence between the beginning of this passage and the rest of it, the beginning talking about length of life, children and sustenance, and the examples given are exactly corresponding to that. The first is length of life. This one lived 92 years, this one 40 years. The second is children, in other words, people in the family, relatives, children, cousins getting married or dying. And the third is sustenance. This one had kol tuv, had the best of all that's available to eat, and this one barely had the barley bread for him and his family and his children. But they were both saintly rabbis, and if the principle is one of hashkacha pratit, divine providence, and if we assume that divine providence, individual divine providence, usually works in a reactive fashion based on your deeds, well, they were both saintly, and the proof is that when they prayed for rain, it came. So God listened to them. So why didn't they both have wonderful benefits as far as life and children and sustenance? What could the answer be? The answer is mazal. That's the way it was meant to be in the stars. So that's this source in a nutshell. And now, before we go further with it, I want to back up and talk about this idea of astrology in general. There's so much that can be said. Literally, books have been written on astrology. There's libraries of astrology and on the history of astrology. I'll open up with a sentence that I learned in the course of my studies in Jewish philosophy 20 years ago. Listen to this. It's unbelievable. That whereas today we think of astronomy and astrology as two separate and completely different things, until 1,000 years ago, in most cultures of the world, at least Western cultures, there was no distinction between astrology and astronomy. They weren't thought of as two different fields of endeavor. Rather, astronomy, astrology, again the same thing, was actually one of the first sciences developed in the ancient world, among the Babylonians, among the Egyptians. It was extremely important, of course, for practical reasons, to know about the seasons, to know about the cycle of nature, when it would rain, when it wouldn't rain, for planting, for crop rotation, for sustenance. And they scanned the stars. They developed understanding the way the planets move and the way the planets influence weather and seasons. And it was a seamless move from there into an understanding of how the planets also influence human behavior and everything that happens on Earth. Like, in our mind, they're two separate things, astronomy and astrology. One is Baba Mises, right? One is superstition and nonsense for most moderns. That's astrology. Whereas astronomy is a serious science. But just think of it. Astronomy, among other things, teaches us how the planets and their courses influence the tides, right? And the seasons, right?
And they travel.
And they travel, right? They navigate it. That's very important, right? And astrology claims that those same planets influence not only the tides and the seasons and the weather and the rain and the cold and the hot, but also influences what happens on Earth. If I get killed in a car accident, if a snake bites me, if the walls fall down on me, if I get a disease, or if I'm an angry person or a forgiving person, it was all the same thing to the ancients.
I am thinking today, I look out, I don't see stars. I haven't in years. I grew up seeing stars. But when I camp out in a sleeping bag in the Negev or Sinai, and I see those stars, I can feel how our forefathers must have looked at them. Will the sun rise again? There are the stars. Millions of them. Look out today. You don't see them. You're lucky if you see three.
Right, Dallas, there's too much light
to
see the stars.
So our kids have not grown up.
It's a good point.
See stars.
It's a good point. Right? And the stars are there always watching over us.
That's it.
So anyway, Maimonides, actually, who died in 1204, was one of the earliest and most famous authorities that came out against astrology and started developing the distinction between astrology and astronomy. Now, that's not to say that no one made that distinction before him. There were some of the Gaonim, the Babylonian Gaonim, the authorities that headed the Shivot in Babylonia in the 700s, 800s, and 900s, that also had some things to say pejoratively about astrology. But really, it maintains its stature through the time of the Rambam, and even after the Rambam came out against astrology. You have the Ramban, who attacks the Rambam on this. You have the Ibn Ezra, who wrote whole books on astrology. And until the 1700s, you have many, many major scientific and religious figures who understand that astrology and astronomy are one and the same. And that, okay, today, basically, it looks like only wackos still believe in astrology. But I'll just tell you a short story. There's nothing to do with anything. When I grew up, From third grade till about 10th grade, my parents were members of a Reform temple in Bayshore, Long Island, in New York. And the rabbi there, who, by the way, his son is a major Jewish figure in Texas, the rabbi there was the president of the American Association of Astrologers, I remember. And he actually used to give presentations on astrology. I think he actually believed it, they say. I don't know. Anyway, the rabbi's name, by the way, was Louis Dobin, and his son... The rabbi is Joel Dobin, and Louis Dobin...
Louis Dobin is the head of Green Family Camp.
Right. So there's a connection to Texas. But anyway...
I have a question. Where is it written? I read somewhere that God said to Abraham, do not look at the stars.
We'll get to that. It's in the sources right here.
Oh, okay.
Very good. That's 2 points.
Okay.
The Rambam came out against astrology, and he came out fiercely against astrology in many of his writings for two reasons. One was scientific. The Rambam writes that he read all the books of astrology that were available to him in his time and came to the conclusion that scientifically it just doesn't hold water. Empirically, he doesn't think that they've proven their point based on the available data. That's one point. And then the Rambam says, secondly, there's a great objection to astrology based on the Torah, because the Torah's most important principle for the Rambam is free will, that human beings are in control of their own actions, whereas astrology claims that it's because of the stars that I kill, or that I refrain from killing, that I steal or refrain from stealing, that I am intelligent or that I'm foolish. It all depends on the stars. And the Rambam says, if that's the case, then there's no place for the mitzvot of the Torah. There's no place for any type of accounting.
Yeah, there's a passage in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. It's not in the stars, but in ourselves.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, what I think we have to do in studying the sources we're going to see today that have to do with providence and astrology, we have to skirt the Rambam's two objections to astrology. As I don't want this to turn into a discussion, is astrology true or false? That's not our subject. Our subject is providence. And the study of astrology merely shines some light on providence. Let me explain how I think we should skirt the 2 points that the Rambam made. The first, that astrology is scientifically false, and secondly, that it contradicts the Torah because of free will. As far as the Rambam's point that astrology is scientifically false, for us that should be totally irrelevant, because what we want to do is look at astrology as a representative of the scientific understanding that there are certain frameworks and forces and processes that are part of nature that were set up by God at the outset but are no longer directly controlled by God. And these forces determine to a large degree what happens to us on Earth. They used to call it astrology. We call it genetics. Or we call it geology, or we call it meteorology. In other words, it's not specifically astrology we're talking about, it's rather the fact that there's such a thing that's called nature that determines to a certain degree what happens on Earth. And of course, we may not believe in astrology, I don't, but I do believe in genetics. Right? I do believe that there's such a thing as heredity. I do believe that there's such a thing as geological forces that might cause an earthquake or a tsunami or something similar to happen right now or another month or another 100 years. And those things affect our lives. So let's just talk about astrology as natural forces that are set in place and happen because of the fact that they're set in place and not because of any direct hashkacha pratit at the moment. That's point number one. As far as the Rambam's objection to astrology on the basis of the Torah, that it contradicts free will, I think we should also put that objection aside for now for the following reason. We can simply focus on astrology as it doesn't affect free will, but as it affects the things that happen in the world. Let me explain myself. The astrologists believe that astrology affects what happens to me if I die or if I live, if I have food or I don't have food, if my children succeed or not, and also affects, according to the astrologists, how I behave. Now, we can simply divide between the two. Let's not talk about astrology as it affects my behavior. That will lead for free will. But let's talk about astrology as it claims the stars affect what happens to us. So if we can follow those two directives, we can study about astrology without getting bogged down in issues that are liable to bog us down.
Rabbi Zef taught this seminar last semester.
Yes.
And my feeling then, and it still is, and I didn't express it then, was that the stars determine where we're born and where we live and how what happens to us. And I just think in terms of us, if we had been born in Kovno or Vilna or Odessa or Salonika, we would be dead. As opposed to where we were born and we live. So the stars determine what happens to us to a large degree. That was my feeling about the stars, is to... It's not consistent with what you say, but I thought about that when Zev said it. You say it again, and I still feel very strongly that determines what happens to us.
I think the pogroms make a big difference.
Okay, and that's important. I don't think it has to affect the particular sources and what we want to get out of them.
When we're talking about the stars, are we completely excluding the moon and the sun?
No, we're not.
Okay, because I see the moon with tides affecting our food supplies, as the sun does, more so to me than the stars.
Yeah, and again, that's where kind of you already see the blurring of the boundary between astronomy and astrology.
And agronomy.
And we understand why the ancients didn't have such a distinction.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the way in which the moon is determines what the tides are.
Yeah.
And your moon.
Yeah. 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 So after all that introduction, if we go back to the story and examine it, it looks like there is a mood of resignation, I would say, in the story we just read. Look, they are both saintly rabbis. Why was it, how could it be, that Rabbah suffered so much? But he did. And there's no explanation for it, except for that's the way it is.
Well, don't we go back to... he's suffering because of what his forefathers did?
That's exactly what we don't go back to, right? That's a very good point. That's a wonderful point. They could have said in this source, they could have said, we'll look for an explanation of why Rabbah suffered so much. Perhaps God was making him suffer in order to increase his reward in the world to come. Perhaps God was having him suffer because his father or his father's father was a rasha. There are a number of different explanations we saw in the sources we've looked at for the past 4 months, and I think it's important that this source does not harness those reasons, but gives a scientific reason. And I'm calling astrology scientific, not because I believe in it, because it's a stand and it's a representative of the idea that there are natural forces that are going in their course, like we saw last time, the time before, Olam kimin hago noheg. The world follows its natural course. That's the way God set it up. And astrology for the ancients is part of science, is part of the natural course that the world follows. Now, I think it's fascinating that the source says that both of these two saintly rabbis prayed for rain, and it came. In other words, their prayers were answered. That is to say that there's a deep belief in this source in Hashkacha Pratit, that God is there, and God listens to our prayers. So if God listens, and God brought rain when this one prayed and that one prayed, then why couldn't God make Rabbah's life a little bit better and a little bit longer? But he didn't. It looks like, to a certain degree, God's arms are tied. Whether God's arms are tied behind his back against his will, or because that's the way he set it up to begin with, or that's not
the third
question.
He just didn't have any.
That's not. That's not the question. For some reason, God set it up like that, that most things, and these are most things, this is most of life, length of life, children and sustenance, most things are determined by scientific factors, natural factors that are beyond our control, and God has put them even out of God's control. According to this source. So this is even though the subject is astrology, which is so far from me, the truth is this source is really very, very relevant to a modern understanding of the world, a modern scientific understanding of the world, that most of what happens is not a function of our deeds, and it's not a function of God's decision at the moment. It's the way God set up the world, and there might be certain rare times when God hears my prayer and changes my mazal, but that's rare. According to this source, it usually doesn't happen.
Or he says no. People who believe God says no.
Yeah, I'm just relating to the source, right? God listened to their prayers for rain, but I'm sure they also prayed. I'm sure Rava prayed also for sustenance and for the life of his children and for a long life. He didn't get that.
Well, we don't know that.
That's what it says. What don't we know?
We don't know that he prayed for those things.
I would bet my fortune on it. If he said the Shmona Esrei every day, then he was praying for those things.
Right. And he doesn't pray for their children.
But maybe in his heart of hearts, there were other things in his life that meant more. We don't know.
It's hard to believe that he didn't want to live a day after the age of 40, that he didn't want his children to survive, that he didn't want to have something to eat. Of course he wanted those things, but he didn't get it.
He just read this paragraph.
He didn't get it. Okay? Next source. The next source is out of this world. Literally. I've been making a joke.
The first one was it, right?
The first one wasn't out of this world. I gave a class on Monday night in which someone, after I told a certain midrash, she just did like this. And I said, yeah, that was out of this world, right?
Oh, I thought
that
was over the top. Went over him.
No, it was over the top, right? It was. So this next source is over the top. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Tanit, page 25a. Rabbi Elazar ben Padat found himself in very great want. Once, after having his blood let, he had nothing to eat. Now, bloodletting is like going to the doctor and getting your once a year physical.
It was a source of healing at that time.
A source of healing.
The barbers used to do it, though.
And he had nothing to eat to strengthen himself after the bloodletting. He took the skin of garlic and put it into his mouth, which of course is worth nothing, both medicinally and nutritionally, and it's also doesn't cost anything. You can find the skin of garlic on this floor. He became faint, then he fell asleep. So he was obviously a little bit woozy at this moment. The rabbis coming to see him, to visit him after the bloodletting, noticed that he was crying and laughing, and that a ray of light was radiating from his forehead in his sleep. When he awoke, they asked him, "Why did you cry and laugh?" He replied, "Because the Holy One, blessed be He, was sitting by my side while I was dreaming, in my dream. And I asked Him, 'How long will I suffer in this world?' I asked God. And He replied, 'Elazar, my son, would you rather that I should turn back the world to its very beginnings? Perhaps you might then be born at a happier hour.'" That's the key. It's God says to him, if you want a different fate, all I could do is destroy the world, recreate it. Implication being, perhaps you would be born under a different mazal, and then your fate would be different. It looks like God is saying, I don't have the power, or at least I've made an operational decision never to exercise such power. I don't get involved in mazal. And the fact that you have nothing to eat, that's the stars. I'm sorry. There's nothing I can really do about it. I replied, this is Rabbi Elazar telling the rabbis what he said to God in his dream. I replied, all this and then only perhaps. In other words, God had said, if I destroy the world and recreate it, perhaps you'll be born in a happier hour. But perhaps not. So God can't even guarantee a better fate if he destroys the world and makes it again.
So he's totally useless at that point. He couldn't readjust the stars.
Okay. Right? In other words, God does not get involved in who is born under what constellation. That's part of the natural course. Olam keminhago noheg. The world follows its natural course. Very disconcerting and disappointing for Rabbi Elazar ben Padat. I then asked him, so in the dream, Rabbi Elazar, as he's relating to the rabbis, went on and asked God, which is the longer period of my life? The one that I had already lived, or the one I am still to live? He replied, God said, the one that I have already lived. You have less years left than the years you lived already. How does God know? Because God studied astrology. Right? God's not in charge, according to this, in a direct fashion, but God knows the future, and he knows the way the stars are aligned. I then said to him, if so, I do not want it. In other words, I'm not going to obligate you to destroy the world and recreate it for my fate, because I only have a few years left anyway. The implication being, had God said that he has a lots of years left to live, then Rabbi Elazar ben Padat would have said to God, please do recreate the world and try again, because my fate is really bad. I don't like being hungry all the time. He replied, God said, as a reward for refusing it, refusing my offer to recreate the world for you, I will grant you in the next world 13 rivers of balsam oil as clear as the Euphrates and the Tigris, which you will be able to enjoy. I asked, and nothing more? He replied, and what shall I then give to your fellow man? I said, do I then ask the share of one who has nothing? He thereupon snapped at my forehead and exclaimed, Elazar, my son, I have shot you with my arrows. What does that mean? Not clear. Rashi says it means he kind of tapped them on the shoulder, on the forehead, as a sign of love. The last two or three lines don't really matter. Some claim the text is actually corrupt, and it's not clear. But the main text is very clear, and this is really a strange passage, but it ratifies the conclusions we came to from the previous passages. God created the world. Olam keminhago noheg. Certain natural forces. And God may like or not like what goes on, but that's the way it is. People have free will, but their actions, for good or bad, will not determine if they die in a car accident or not tomorrow. They will determine, one's moral actions will determine what happens in Olam Haba, according to this source. In other words, this source seems to say that God has control, much more control over the future world than he has over the present world, at least as far as individual providence goes. Perhaps general providence is a different story. Perhaps God is in charge, indeed, of the larger course of human events and the direction history goes forward in. But as far as what happens to the individual, God, all he can do is reward you in the next world. But in this world, Olam keminhago noheg.
This is not so far-fetched as it might seem in the modern world, because I've forgotten the name of the person that did a long series on public television, maybe Chip or Joe or Jim or somebody, talking about the evolution of the universe. I mean, he had
Carl Sagan?
Yes, yes.
Say the name again, Carl?
See, and you just mentioned three men instead of women.
I know.
Well,
I could have rounded that off.
Right?
All right. Apologize. But the point is that in one of those episodes, he sort of dealt with the idea. He was talking about the creation of the world and the Big Bang. And if you, and he was, the point being is that if this assumption is a basis of thought, that some things started and they went out like this from the Big Bang, and that all the things that we see today are a result of all of that, just using logic alone, you would say that everything that happens is a result of that one instance, and that they, and any interaction you see today could be traced back. In other words, you could rewind that and get back to the Big Bang, and that was part of this show and discussion and whatever. So that he even had subsequent shows. I think the basis of it, that we, meaning humans, are made out of stardust. And he has a show that is, in essence, that all the molecules that ended up on Earth that ultimately evolved into humans really came from this stardust. So if you extrapolate that idea, that things were set in motion, even to the point of the creation of humanity or life on this planet, we'll just go that far, that you could trace it back to a kind of a cosmologic event that was set in motion, for which that has sort of once set in motion, it can't be altered, which is a very interesting thing to contemplate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not inconsistent with this idea.
Right.
Doesn't that
very
have
good.
A little touch good. Of the Kabbalistic in it? When all the some things are in that pot that's broke in the jar, and once again, it's like things flying out and around.
I don't think we have to connect it to anything Kabbalistic. It stands on its own merit.
Well, I mean, everything in the universe is made up. I mean, all of our universe has basically four different elements. We've got hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. And everything, including me, in our bodies, that's what we are. We're mainly water, but also hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. And so we are intricately connected to our surroundings in the universe, and everything came from some force that put out all of it and made all of it. Everything looks different, but it's all made up of those four elements, including myself.
And the carbon.
That's the hydrogen talking.
That's the hydrogen talking.
I haven't talked to the other.
And the carbon, you can relate it to diamonds and heat.
No, if it was hydrogen talking,
our voice would be a lot.
Jim.
On the other hand, in Israel yesterday, Jay Bekenstein of the Hebrew University was given the Wolf Prize, which is a predecessor of the Nobel Prize, for his research on explaining the black hole.
Explaining?
The black hole.
Black hole.
And so, you know, on the other hand, what people are doing in Israel today is they're not accepting this as it. They're studying and understanding why it happens.
Well, not all the people.
Well, but I mean...
Okay.
Which I think is, rather accepting things happen because they happen. In Israel today, they're figuring out why does it happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is contrary to the fact that things just happened.
Might not be contrary. It could be that there's a natural course in which things are just flowing out and working themselves out from an original creation. We can understand the why, but that won't change it. But that's really off topic a little bit. Harry, who's going to bring us back to topic?
Religious-wise. Not scientific wise, how do we explain this expanding universe of us? It's growing and growing and growing.
I don't know, except to say that it's easy to postulate that part of the original creation was a plan that set things in motion, and they're just moving according to the plan.
The whole universe is changing, but I mean, it's like the volcanoes that the lava that's flowing down in Hawaii, it's destroying everything in its path. Yet it hits the water, and it's now making a new island.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
That's how islands are formed.
Exactly. So yes, everything is changing, but all from sort of natural sources.
Mm-hmm.
They also say it's changing
from
the ozone layer.
Yeah. Remember, anyone who heard me speak about Rav Avraham Yitzhak Cohen Cook's reaction to Charles Darwin's theory of the evolution of species, Rav Cook had claimed that Darwin discovered, quote-unquote, the ancient principle of Judaism and of Kabbalah, that everything is developing, everything is changing, everything is evolving, everything is coming closer and closer to God. Everything is being perfected according to a divine plan. In other words, I'm saying it's not hard, following Rav Cook, to reconcile development and evolution with religion, but that's not really our subject.
But you have elevated Rabbi Cook over the last few years, in my mind. You have raised him up.
Well, he raised himself up. Okay. So now, we have actually seen today, in the past 40 minutes, two of the three sources we want to focus on. And now we get to the third source, which is the longest and most intricate. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, page 156a to 157a. So it expands. It spans three different folios here. It was stated, Rabbi Chanina said, the Mazal gives wisdom, the Mazal gives wealth, and Israel is ruled by Mazal. Just to break that statement down, to deconstruct it, not only says Rabbi Chanina, as a general rule, scientific principle, that Mazal is in control of wisdom and wealth, but furthermore, don't tell me that the Jews are beyond the natural course of things. Even Israel, even the Jews, are ruled by the same natural scientific laws that everyone else is ruled by. But Rabbi Yochanan maintained that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. And what Rabbi Yochanan means is that it may be true that in general that Mazal gives wisdom and wealth, but that's only for 99% of the world. But the Jews are beyond Mazal because the Jews have a special relationship with God in which there is such a thing as Hashkacha Klalit and Hashkacha Pratit, different levels of providence in which it's not nature. However you want to call nature, call it genetics, call it astrology. It's not nature, it's rather what God wants for us, whether it's reactive or proactive, it's hashkacha. So that's the machloket, a major machloket here, between Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Yochanan. Now Rabbi Yochanan is consistent with his view, because he said the same thing someplace else. Rabbi Yochanan said in a different place, how do we know that Israel is not ruled by Mazal? I'll bring you a verse that proves it. Because it is said, and this is a verse from Jeremiah, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven. For the nations are dismayed at them, they are dismayed, but not Israel. In other words, in the nations, when they ask the astrologer, what does this sign say about me? And the astrologer says that the constellations teach you're going to die tomorrow. Then if you're a non-Jew, you should be very dismayed, very upset, because it's probably true. But if you're a Jew, don't worry. If you're a Jew, you don't have to listen to the astrologers. Well,
that's right.
You agree with Rabbi Chanina. But Rabbi Yochanan says differently. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan seems to say that the Jew has a hope of overcoming the natural forces, and I assume it means through his deeds, good or bad, and his prayer. That's Rabbi Yochanan's position.
Yeah, but if I read this correctly, what he's saying is don't pay any attention to the signs, to the mazel, to what the stars say. They don't mean anything.
For you, they don't mean anything.
Yeah.
It could be he's saying that. It could be he's saying a little bit less than that. As we read on, we'll see.
Alright.
As we read on, we'll see. But Harry's right that if you take it at face value, it looks like if we translate this into the modern idiom, that Rabbi Yochanan would be saying, if you're a non-Jew, get your checkup every year. If you're Jewish, just do good deeds and pray. Right? If you take it to its extreme, that's the way we might interpret.
I wasn't taking it that way.
Well, sometimes I'm more extreme than you are. But I was taking a cue from you.
Well,
But in the end, we'll see that's not true. In the end, we'll see that's not true. That Rabbi Yochanan doesn't take his view to that extreme. No one does here. Rav, the name of another rabbi, holds that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. The nations are ruled by Mazal, but Israel is not. For Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name, how do we know that Israel is not ruled by Mazal? And it's going to bring the Midrash that Stephanie hinted to half an hour ago. In order to read this Midrash, we're going to open up the Chumash. If you have a Chumash, we're going to open up to Genesis chapter 15.
Genesis,
that's Bereshit, for those who don't know English.
Chapter 15. Genesis, we know. 15 what, though? Oh, I see.
I'm going to read chapter 15 from verse 1 to verse 6. Now, you just remember, of course, that Abraham was 75 when he was chosen by God. He had no children. His wife was 10 years younger. And chapter 12 and 13 and 14 of Genesis talk about the time, fact that time is marching forward. Abraham and Sarah are getting older and no children are born to them, despite the fact that God promised they'll have a lot of seed and become a multitude of nations.
He said you'll be have as many as the stars in the sky.
Right.
Which goes to Mazal.
Exactly. No, you're right. It does. We're connecting to that right now. Sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Avram in a vision. He said, fear not, Avraham, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. But Avram said, O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless? And the one in charge of my household is domestic Eliezer. He's a foreigner. He's my inheritor. I don't have a child. Avram said further, since you have granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir. The word of the Lord came to him in reply, that one shall not be your heir. None but your very own Ishmael shall be your heir. Mm-hmm. He took him outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to count them. And he added, so shall your offspring be. And because he put his trust in the Lord, he reckoned it to his merit. Okay. There's a famous midrash on the verses we just read, which is quoted in what we are presently studying. So as we keep the verses open and look at the Talmudic passage as it goes on, here we are again. For Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name, how do we know that Israel is not ruled by Mazal? Because it is said, quote, and he brought him outside. I see I have a misprint, I wrote him twice. And that's the verse we just read in chapter 15, verse 5. He took him outside. God took Avram outside to show him the stars. So the Midrash, basing himself on that verse, says as follows. Avraham pleaded before the Holy One, blessed be He, sovereign of the universe, my steward will be my heir. Right? I have no children. Mm-hmm. Not so, he replied. None but your very own issue shall be your heir. Sovereign of the universe, cried he, I have looked at my astrological signs and have found that I am not fated to beget a child. Go forth from your astrological studies, for Israel is not ruled by Mazal. That's the Midrash. In other words, let me explain the Midrash. In the Midrash, when it says in verse 5, he took him outside, what the Midrash interprets that to mean is God took Avram outside of astrology. He took him out of the astrological world, the astrological worldview. And God said, despite those stars, which may be against you having children, you'll have as many children as there are stars. Whereas the stars in their astrological formation will not determine your fate.
Yet, you know, those of you that have been to Israel have been to certain synagogues or on the floor of the synagogue.
Ah!
The sign of the Zodiac.
Very good.
That also has the biggest.
Yeah. And which raises a big question, mm-hmm. doesn't it?
Well, the truth is, in light of the sources we saw, it raises no question at all. Because we see that many of the rabbis believe in astrology. Rabbi Elazar ben Padat, of course. Rava, in the name of Rabban and Rabbi Ishta, yeah, of course.
What you're saying is the rabbi that officiated that, say, synagogue A, believed in astrology, and that's why they had a zodiac on the floor there?
Mm-hmm. It was probably, it was certainly the accepted scientific belief of the day. Like, to believe in astrology 2,000 years ago was like to believe in genetics today.
Yeah. Well, you know, years ago I used to go with a crowd that were very strong believers in astrology.
Really?
And but everything is scientific today. You have to know the exact time, hour and minute that you were born before they can do a reading on you.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what went out. I mean, I just knew I was born on a Friday night and the day, but not the hour and minute. And so they couldn't do a deal on me. But they'll take the day you were born, the hour and a minute, and using that, they'll come up with things about you that are amazing, that really are amazing. I mean, it's
okay.
What it's done mathematically.
Okay, we talked a little bit about that in the first 15 minutes, but we're not going to talk about the scientific truth of astrology.
But today I'm talking about...
Yeah.
If you don't know the exact hour and minute of your birth, and if you're going to have one of them give you a reading, it's not going to be accurate. That's my
Harry,
I understand.
You know that. Since you didn't have a reading because you didn't have a source 5 minutes a second, how would you know that whatever they said about somebody else was true or not?
Could be a boogie mice.
Well, no, I'm trying to tell you this is what they claim.
Okay.
This is what they claim.
Why do we have to look for three
they
stars?
They couldn't give
another subject. That's another subject. Okay, so let's go on. Let me point out what we just saw here. We see, of course, this machloket, this disagreement between Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Hanina says that Israel is ruled by Mazal. Rabbi Yochanan says Israel is not ruled by Mazal. And then it says further that Rav also agrees with Rabbi Yochanan that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. And Rav speaks this Midrash. So the Midrash is part and parcel of the worldview that Israel is not ruled by Mazal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now wait a second. But doesn't the Midrash assume that astrology does rule most things? Right? If God has to say to Abraham, I'm taking you out of the astrological framework, that means that usually the astrological framework does determine what happens. But in a special case of Abraham Avinu, because of God's promise to him, because of his good deeds, God takes him out of the astrological influence. What that means is that he who says that Israel is not ruled by Mazal didn't really mean what he said.
But if the word ruled...
Wait a second. What he meant when he said that Israel is not ruled by Mazal, he meant that Israel is not always ruled by Mazal, but sometimes, usually, most of the time it is.
But isn't the word ruled incorrect? Should it be influenced?
I debated how to translate it.
Jewish people are ruled by God. See my point?
No, I don't see it at all. That's exactly what we're talking about right now. You're assuming what we have to figure out from the sources. The sources talk about the following. Yesh Mazal l'Yisrael or Ein Mazal Yisrael. Meaning, there is Mazal for Jews or there isn't. I translate as ruled by, but I added that word ruled. The Hebrew says, Ein Mazal l'Yisrael. Israel doesn't have Mazal. I was afraid if I just wrote that, you'd think it means we have no luck.
Right.
So, but let me just finish the thought, and then Dorothy. So we have to understand this clearly, that those who say that Israel is not influenced by Mazal, under Mazal, ruled by Mazal, what they really mean is Israel is not always ruled by Mazal, but usually it is. The opinion that says that Israel is ruled by Mazal, therefore must be holding that Israel is always ruled by Mazal. There's no exceptions. So to summarize, the machloket here, the argument between Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yochanan, the argument is the follows. Rabbi Hanina says that Israel is subject to the natural order of things without exception, just like the rest of the world. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehud, in the name of Rav, they hold there's also a natural order. That's called Tir Mazal. And that rules most of what happens. But rather, Israel has the possibility of sometimes, in rare cases, being exempt from Mazal, and that's when God's will kicks in. God's direct will can change and can overcome, can override the Mazal.
But man's cannot.
I assume it means that God may override the Mazal, perhaps because of your good deeds.
But can man by himself overrule Mazal?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Dorothy wanted to say something.
Well, this belief in Mazal is opposite from of idols.
Of what?
Of worshipping idolism.
No. Again, keep that out of it. When it says Mazal, just think of genetics. We don't want to go into a discussion if it's a true science or a false science. I believe it's false, but it's irrelevant. Just call it science. Just call it genetics. Just call it natural forces. I don't know who was next here.
Over there.
Over there, okay.
But does it exclude the possibility that other peoples will also sometimes, similar to Jews, that is not always ruled by these forces? Does it exclude the possibility?
That's a good question. I would say that the simple meaning of the thing is that Rabbi Yochanan's position is that Israel is unique.
Well, yes, but my question is, it's not such a comprehensive statement that it doesn't exclude the possibility that other peoples might also operate outside of the natural order, occasionally. We don't know.
Okay.
Excluded, so.
Right. That's taking away from the uniqueness of Israel that Rabbi Yochanan wants to emphasize.
Well, the thing that popped into my mind are the things that were God derivatives that affected other peoples. The Red Sea crashing in on the Egyptians, for example.
Okay, so that's true.
A thousand other different examples.
Right, because Israel doesn't have Mazal, and God intervenes against the Mazal for them. It may affect other people. That's true. The Egyptians will be killed because of the fact that God intervenes against the Mazal for the Jews. Harry, and then we'll go here.
It appears that one says that we are influenced by Mazal, tells me that negates the concept of free will.
You missed the first 20 minutes of the class. We talked all about that.
Well, what did you come out with?
Listen to the tape.
You can buy the tape.
She's a good businesswoman.
You can buy three free shipping.
Jeff.
It seems to me that this is an example of a fantastic creative thought processes by the rabbi, because why does the stars actually in this case mean mazel or mazal? Maybe it just means when you are trying to describe something that is a very, very large number, because they didn't have the capacity to say trillion, billion, quadzillion, or whatever, that they're the thing that you could point to might be grains of sand on the beach, or the number of stars in the sky, because it was just a big, big number. Why does that imply that you're talking about, you know, the control of people or the rule of people by the stars? And how do you interpret the fact that God took Abraham out and pointed to the stars, and that was taking him out of the realm of astrology, when it sounds like he's putting him right in the middle of it? I mean, you're turning it upside down. It doesn't even say anything like that.
Okay, you said a few things.
This rabbi is turning it upside down. I won't give you the blame.
Yes, okay, so let's start. So the Midrash, the verses say that God took Avram outside and showed him the stars. Mm-hmm. And the Midrash is primarily focusing on the first words, God took him out. Mm-hmm. And it's interpreting that God took him out, it means God took him out of his prevailing way of thinking. God disabused him of his way of thinking.
But this is a classic example of taking something out of context.
Of course it is.
Okay.
So, it's Midrash. In other words...
This is great for your everyday politics. Just take the words out of context.
Okay, so... But let's not focus presently on the methodology of Midrash.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's a given that there is such a thing as a methodology of Midrash. It takes for a set of context to prove a point that is not necessarily intrinsically proven by the verses themselves.
Yes.
But what the Midrash does want to say is that there is such a thing as planetary influence, but at a certain time, for a certain person, God took that person out of the planetary influence. And indeed, it's ironic that God took him out of the planetary influence and then showed him the stars.
Yeah.
And the point there is that for most people, the stars determine what's going to happen to you. For me, however, says God, or for us in this case, myself, God, and you, Abraham, the stars do not determine it, and I'm going to give the stars a new meaning, says God. The stars for you mean the number of descendants you will have. So God is for Avram totally undoing all the astrological connections and influences. But more than that, I can't say.
Well, it's, you know, looking at this, it seemed like what I get out of it is, you know, of course we know God is a God of history. What he's saying is, for the world in general, you know, the natural course will follow, except. And that's when he becomes, you know, a God of history of the Jewish people, in
right.
that they're the exception. Israel collectively is the exception, and I have a plan for them. And then how Israel or the collective peoplehood relate to other governments, other things in the world, they will be affected by my plan for Israel, or
100%.
The peoplehood,
yeah,
and he's saying, I am the God of history for the peoplehood of the Jewish people.
100%, absolutely. And this Midrash is brought in a number of different philosophical Jewish books to make the exact point that Martin is making. But I just want to emphasize, to go back to things we said, that the source doesn't say that there's no astrological influence upon the Jews. It just says sometimes there isn't. Because how do I know that for certain from the source? Because it says that God had to do a specific act of taking Abraham out of the Mazal. That seems indicative that until that act, Abraham was part of the Mazal. And we're going to see that again and again as this source goes
it's
on.
It's like taking someone who cooks in a restaurant or eats in a restaurant out and says, now you can go in and eat. I mean, he's in something. He believes he's taking him out, then he's putting him back in.
He's not putting him back in.
Oh, he said there's some mazel.
Okay, but on this particular matter, having a child, there is not. Let's go on with the source, okay? Now it says, what is thy calculation? Oh, I see. I printed it wrong.
I'm lost, then. It's the last.
It goes on to because tzedek.
Oh, okay.
And I should have had space between the word because and the line before, which was the footnotes.
So it's Jupiter. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Midrash goes on to say that God said to Abraham, "What is thy calculation?" In other words, what brought you to believe that according to astrological patterns, you would not have children. And God said to him, is it because Jupiter stands in the west? In other words, God knows astrology. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were looking at? And then God says to Abraham, I will turn it back and place it in the east. And it brings a verse, and that says, written, who hath raised up Tzedek from the east, he hath summoned it for his sake, for Abraham's sake. Now this is fantastic. Because what it says is, the only means that God has to change Abraham's fate is to move the planets. Mm-hmm. Understand the significance of that? Mm-hmm. It's not that God can just zap and Abraham's fate would be different. God has to work within the framework of Mazal, according to this. Wow.
Which is natural order.
Which is the natural order. In other words, it emphasizes the end, even according to those who hold that Israel is not influenced by Mazal, even they hold that for God to make it that the Jews will not be influenced by Mazal, God has to manipulate the Mazal. He can't work outside the Mazal, according to this. Which is, of course, very similar to the story about Rabbi Elazar ben Padat. That if God wanted to change his fate, God would have to change the Mazal. So even God is ruled, even God has to work within the framework of the Mazal, and that's according to those who hold that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. Those who hold that Israel is ruled by Mazal, they hold that God can't even change the planets to change the fate, that God has nothing he can do. Okay. So now we're going to read on. Now it tells a story. The Midrash is finished. For Samuel and Ablat were sitting. Now Samuel, that's Shmuel. He's a Babylonian Amorah. The year is about 200 of the Common Era in Babylonia. Ablat is a Babylonian astrologer, a non-Jewish friend of his. For Shmuel and Ablat were sitting while certain people were going to a lake. Said Ablat to Shmuel, that man is going but will not return, for a snake will bite him and he will die. So in other words, there is Shmuel and Ablat sitting on a park bench and they're sitting and they're watching people stroll by the lake. And Ablat takes out his astrological charts and aligns them and looks at the stars and sees that man over there. He says, that man over there, a snake's going to bite him. I see it in the stars. That's what happens. If he is an Israelite, replied Shmuel, he will go and return. What is Shmuel saying? He's saying that your astrology doesn't apply to Jews. It only applies to non-Jews. We don't know if that guy's Jewish or not, but if he's Jewish, he'll live because he'll be exempt from the astrological influence. While they were sitting, he went and returned. In other words, that guy who was supposed to die didn't die. Which means, of course, that Ablat is pretty upset because his scientific theory didn't work out, didn't pan out. Thereupon, Ablat arose and threw off the man's knapsack. I guess Ablat is trying to figure out if the guy is Jewish or not.
That's not how you find out.
And found a snake therein, cut up and lying in two pieces. So what happened? A snake did try to attack the guy, but the guy managed to attack the snake. So there was something to this astrology, but it didn't completely work out as Ablat thought it would. Said Shmuel to him. Shmuel said to the guy who was supposed to die, but managed to live. What did you do? In other words, what did you do to survive the snake attack? Every day we pooled our bread and ate it. But today one of us had no bread and he was ashamed. So we have a group of 5-6 guys. We always have lunch together and we all give in a piece of bread and then I make sandwiches from it and we give it out to the guys. We eat together. And one guy today had no bread and he was ashamed of it. Said I to them, I will go and collect the bread. I'll be the guy today who collects the bread and makes the sandwiches. When I came to him, the guy who didn't have anything to give, I pretended to take bread from him so that he would not be ashamed. I didn't tell the other guy that this guy today didn't have money for bread. You have done a good deed, said Samuel to the potential snake victim. Then Shmuel went out and taught, Tzedaka tatzil mimavet. Charity delivers from death. And this does not mean from an unnatural death, but from death itself. Let's think about this story. So it looks like the story is saying, first of all, that Shmuel is among those rabbis who hold Ein Mazal LeYisrael. There's no Mazal for Yisrael. No Mazal to Yisrael. And the story is supposed to prove it. And Shmuel has this famous friend of his, this astrologer, who predicts what's going to happen based on the stars. And in this case, it's not that it didn't happen, it almost happened, right? The snake did try to bite him, but he was saved. Why was he saved? Because of his good deeds. Implication being, had he not been Jewish, or even had he been Jewish but not done the good deed, he wouldn't have been saved. Which means, again, as I said earlier, that those who hold, like Shmuel and like Rabbi Yochanan and like Rav, that there's no mazal for the Jews, what it means is there is mazal, but sometimes the mazal can be overridden by special, unique factors. In this case, the unique factor is tzedaka, is our good deeds.
That's similar to the time it took us in the, you know, the high holidays. Tzedaka averts the severe decree. In some way, it's not an exact parallel.
Right, it's about one system that can override another system. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it sort of answers Jim's question too. Is that can individuals get overcome?
Ah, right. In the sense that God overcomes it for them on the basis of their deeds.
But the last sentence, but not from death itself.
In other words, it's not that the mazal will make sure that your death is less painless. It can really cancel death, not just change the type of death you suffer from, but actually cancel it completely.
Which is a curse to outlive everyone.
A curse? No. It doesn't mean to outlive
you.
It means that this particular day you're supposed to die, you won't die.
Oh, this day. Okay.
Yeah. The stars say a snake is supposed to bite you today.
Today, you were supposed to die today and you didn't.
You can avoid that completely by, in this case, just protecting someone from being humiliated by his poverty.
Which is what Maimonides said, to shame someone is to kill them.
It comes from the Gemara. Yeah. So, you know, this story is really about, you could say, the confluence between science and religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reconciliation between science, the natural order, in this case astrology, and the Torah's promises that you can be rewarded for your good deeds. And the reconciliation is that usually science rules. Usually the natural order rules. But there are some special cases in which that which rules can be overruled.
But we spent half a year with you talking about it. So much depended on what your forefathers did.
Okay, that was one opinion. I just remembered something. Remember that we learned many months ago the story of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. And the story was very short. It went as follows. That there was a town in which a poisonous snake was killing people. And they called in Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, the tzaddik and miracle worker, to do something about it. And what he did is he came to the town, he took off his shoe, and stood on the viper's hole. And the viper came and bit him, and the viper died. Remember that story?
Yeah.
And Rabbi Chanina said, this proves that the snake doesn't kill, but rather sin kills.
Sin.
And he who has no sin will not die. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa claimed there is no natural order. It all depends on your deeds. Whereas these sources claim there is a natural order, sometimes your merit can overcome that. But these sources don't claim there's no natural order. That's the reason why I brought Rabbi Hanina at the beginning of our study, because his position was pure and radical. There's no natural order. It all depends on your merit. Well, this is a much more nuanced source. There is a natural order, but it can be overcome.
interesting that snakes have come up quite a lot lately. The one in the wall.
We have another snake on the next page.
Well, actually, this has even further reaching implications, because a natural order implies that things will go according to a certain set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
And here in this instance, a rule or the future of maybe even mankind was changed by the alter of a natural order. So that the man whose life was predicted to be ended by a snake bite, whose life was not it, say that that had occurred, that would have replicated itself through the effects it has on all the people that were associated with his family, his future family, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a natural order based upon that set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But having changed that one thing, the man did not die, cut up the steak instead, that changed the entire, not only the man's future, but
right.
maybe the future of the world.
Right, right, right. Good point. Good point.
Do we include the natural order as meaning the sun, the earth going around the sun and the moon rising and the seasons? Do we include that as being the astrology, the natural order?
I want to ask you exactly what you mean before I answer that.
No, we talk about the stars.
Now, are the planets included among the stars as things that are part of the astrological influence? Yes.
How about the sun?
Yes.
That's what I asked
you. Yeah, right, Stephanie.
On the other hand, like I said, every Saturday night in Jerusalem, the old days, if we didn't eat the what, had to look up and wait for three stars to eat. It affected me, my nature, my mood.
Well,
Harry.
Well, I understand the crux of the story is the fact that the man actually did something that was charitable, that saved him from death. And ordinarily, he would have died.
Yes.
From the snake bite. But because he did this charitable deed, he was
saved.
He was saved from dying. Is that what the crux of the story is?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
But it's just a story, right?
Well, no, it's really happened.
No, what I mean is, you can make up any kind of a story. But where's the credence?
We're studying texts.
I know, but we're trying to study texts that have some rationale.
Well, that is that person's rationale. That's a point that person wants to make. And
right.
It with a story.
I assume the story really happened. Of course, in my mind, the story happened. But there's two things we read. We read the story and we read an interpretation of the story.
Right.
Right? Shmuel gives the facts a interpretation. Shmuel says the reason you were saved from the snake is because of your deeds, your charitable deeds. Now, that connection that Shmuel makes between the charitable deeds and the outcome, that's not a fact, that's an interpretation. Shmuel didn't see the connection, he made the connection. The story wants to teach us that that's Shmuel's understanding, that there is such a connection. You, or anyone reading the story, can take it or leave it. We're reading it as a text that expresses a certain approach.
What about this item that the snake was cut in half? What bearing does that have?
It goes to show you that there was a snake in the vicinity.
Right.
But this man was able to kill the snake. What gave him the ability to kill the snake? Harry might say it was a coincidence.
Oh, all right.
Shmuel says it was the deed he had done 10 minutes ago of refraining from humiliating his fellow.
Okay. Of course, we have to consider the astrologer that predicted that he was going to be bitten by the snake. How come he couldn't have also known that he was a charitable man, consequently would not have been bitten by the snake?
Because I guess the fact that charity saves from death is not within the astrological science. It breaks the science. That's the whole point, right? That it's beyond the science.
The astrologer was using an argument based upon the astrologer's interpretation of whatever he has, the stars. The stars were going to predict that this man was going to be bitten by a snake. It wouldn't have predicted that he was a charitable person. Could he not have equally predicted that he was a charitable person and there was a snake there, but he wouldn't have been bitten?
The answer is no. Perhaps astrology could have told Ablat that this man was charitable. But the fact that charity will prevent him from dying is not within the realm of astrology. That's God intervening. That's the uniqueness of the Jewish people. That's the fact
that... All things are in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven.
Exactly, right? That the fear of heaven, meaning doing good deeds, affects our lives in the sense that it can overcome the natural order. I'm supposed to die by a snake, but I can overcome that by being taken out of the natural order, like Avram was taken out and given a special dispensation by God.
It seems to me it's obvious why the non-Jewish world felt like the Jews were awfully arrogant and that they were special.
They are special.
I see the difference between this one and the next one, Rabbi Akiva.
Let's read it first. Okay, let's read it. Let's go on. We're going to finish the sheet today. We're now coming to the top of the last sheet of 4 months of study. From Rabbi Akiva 2, we learn that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. For Rabbi Akiva had a daughter. This is a very famous story. Every child by the age of third grade in Israel knows this story. Rabbi Akiva had a daughter. Now astrologers told him, on the day that she enters the bridal chamber, a snake will bite her and she will die. He was very worried about this. Now the fact that Rabbi Akiva was worried, what does that teach you? That he took astrology seriously. This is the science of the time. It's like you went to the doctor with your 12-year-old daughter and the doctor said she has a heart defect, God forbid, she's going to die within a year. And Rabbi Akiva was very worried. But there's nothing he can do. On the day of her marriage, she took a brooch and stuck it into the wall. And it happened to penetrate the eye of a serpent. She didn't know that was what happened. She killed the serpent that was supposed to kill her unknowingly.
The snake was in the wall.
Yeah, that's where snakes are, aren't they?
No.
No, it's called the snake in the grass.
What is that in the wall?
In those days, there were snakes in the wall. The following morning, when she took it out, when she took the brooch out of the wall, the snake came trailing out after it. In other words, she saved her brooch by putting it in the wall, like we put our brooches in felt boxes, right? So she took the brooch out, and she sees that there's a snake attached to it. And she realizes that she had killed the snake last night. What did you do? Her father asked. And Rabbi Akiva understood that this snake was supposed to kill her. Rabbi Akiva understood that somehow the mazal was overcome. So he said, what did you do to deserve God saving you? A poor man came to our door in the evening, she replied. And everyone was busy at the banquet, and there was none to attend to him. So I took the portion which was given to me and gave it to him. The bride gave up her own wedding portion. You have done a good deed, said he to her. Thereupon Rabbi Akiva went out and lectured, charity will deliver from death. And not merely from an unnatural death, but from death itself. Same story as the prior one. And I think it's important again to notice that Rabbi Akiva was very worried that she would die because he knew that astrology is true. And that means even those who hold that there's no astrological influence for the Jews, what it really means is that there usually is, but sometimes there's not, and that sometimes might be very rare. Only a very, very special deed of this type may save you from what the stars have in mind for you.
Just an example. Another example, how Rabbi Akiva doesn't make good decisions like he did on Bar Kafta on this one. He says he worries about it, but any reasonable man would have gone in there and then looked at the bridal chamber and looked for snakes, which he didn't do. He left things to chance. He did
that's
the
true.
You know, he doesn't have good judgment, obviously.
There's something to that.
It could be. There's nothing you can do against snakes.
Well, you go look for them. She's going to get bitten in the bridal chamber.
You don't let
worry about it. You go in there and you scour the bridal chamber.
Okay, whatever.
So it makes no sense. So Rabbi Akiva does not have the judgment.
I think that you're judging him by modern standards. I'm going to refrain from judging him.
I know.
And we're going to finish the last story here. From Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak too, we learn that Israel is not ruled by Mazal. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak's mother was told by astrologers, your son will be a thief. So she did not let him go bareheaded, saying to him, cover your head so that the fear of heaven may be upon you and pray for mercy. Now this is in the period of the Talmud when apparently there was no general custom of Jews covering their heads. Rather, we know from this story and from other stories that it was considered to be a special act of piety to walk around with a head covering. First of all, unmarried men didn't cover their heads, and even married men only if they were on a specially high level of piety.
And women?
I don't know.
That didn't count.
I don't know. So, I said that, and I did not say that, Joe said that. Just setting the record straight. Now, in this particular case, it looks like from a very, very early age, his mother covered his head, which was rare and out of the ordinary, and the reason was because the astrologers had said, your son will be a thief, so she took special precautions to imbue piety upon him so he wouldn't become a thief. Now, he did not know why she spoke to him like that. She didn't tell him about the astrologer. She just said you should always cover your head and pray every day for mercy from God. One day, he was sitting and studying under a palm tree as a grown man. The hood fell off of his head. He didn't notice it. He lifted up his eyes and saw the palm tree. Temptation overcame him. He climbed up and bit off a cluster of dates with his teeth. He stole, even though he's a very famous rabbi, because the kippah fell off his head. So this story, again, on the one hand, is indicative of what we've been saying, that there's no mazal for the Jews, which means there is mazal for the Jews, but you can overcome it through a special act of piety. Now, this story is a little bit different than the others, because all the others talked about things that happened to you. This is talking about you doing things to the world. This is the story.
What's the other story?
That's the end of the story. This story is indicative of one of the reasons why the Rambam rejected astrology. Because here it says that astrology determines your behavior.
Right.
And the Rambam says, how could that be? But so we're not talking about all that. And if you want to keep the discussion clean, we can ignore this last part of the story of Rabbi Nachman, but just talk about Rabbi Kiva's part of the story and Shmuel's part of the story, because that's really our issue. It's not about how you behave. Our issue here with Hashgacha, with Providence, with Theodicy, is how the world behaves towards you. And there we saw that the majority opinion is that there's no mazal for Yisrael, meaning there is mazal for Yisrael. And in general, olam kemin hago noheg, the world follows its natural course, but it's possible to overcome that and wrest yourself out of the framework and the clutches of astrology, of nature, by specific deeds of mitzvot and charity and loving kindness.
So it's on one hand, it's on the other hand.
Is there an implication that if you're not Jewish, that a charitable act will not overcome?
That seems to be an implication.
Yeah. What about Pharaoh's, God's haunting Pharaoh's heart? It implies that Pharaoh had if God hadn't intervened, that he could have had a change of heart.
Because I don't see the point.
Okay.
Okay. And if he had a change of heart, then he wouldn't have been punished by more plagues.
He could have done Shuvah.
Yeah, he could have.
So
Pharaoh could have.
How does that?
Well, if first of all, he's not a Jew.
So I said I don't want to deal with the issue of free will.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Just dealing about how mazal affects what happens to you, not how it affects what you do.
Yeah.
But this is a case where of a non-Jew being in an analogous position.
So, but that's about free will.
All right.
I don't want to deal with the issue of free will.
Last paragraph.
The last sentence. I'm not sure what it tells us.
The last sentence simply says that Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak, despite the fact that he was a very pious and learned man, when the kippah fell off his head, immediately he was drawn into a terrible temptation to steal date palms. That's all.
When the kippah is off, then the natural source...
Natural order kicks in.
Natural order took... Okay.
Well, but that's the case.
then the astrology was true.
That's exactly the point.
Joe.
That even those who hold that the Jews are not ruled by astrology, what they really mean is we are ruled by it, except that we can overcome it.
Oh.
Right? That was the important point here.
Oh, all right.
No, the point is that Joe and Martin and I need to wear a kippa next week.
You might save yourselves from thievery.
That's right.
That's only if, of course, the astrological signs have destined you to be thieves.
But you never
I don't know.
Or not, so you need to wear one.
But he's wearing a hat.
Who's wearing a hat? Oh, Harry
is.
He is.
But Joe and Martin and I.
Okay, so.
That's it.
We have thereby finished, completed our study of theodicy and providence in Chazal.
Hazak.
And the truth is, I'm very, very happy. I've wanted, literally for 20 years, to learn all these sources at once. And I'm so happy we've done that. And now we will go on to providence and theodicy in the writings of the medieval sages. Next week, unless something happens to change my mind, we'll begin learning the Rambam's Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, the third part, where he deals with his interpretation of the book of Job, which is a jumping off point for his whole discussion of providence and theodicy.
Wow.
Okay.
That went a long way.